Live in Philadelphia, welcome to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. It is hot outside. Philly is under a heat health emergency, the first of the season. We're talking excessive heat today. 2023, Avi, was the warmest year since global records began in 1850, and the length and intensity of the heat is expected to get worse. So we got a couple experts on tap. First, we're going to talk to a doctor about what heat does to your body and who's most at risk. We'll talk about that. But then we also have a climate resiliency expert who's going to talk about the shifting intensity and length of these heat waves and what cities can do to better prepare. And a big question is, should we name heat waves? Give us your hot take.
Like we do with hurricanes.
Like we do with hurricanes and, you know, other, you know, even with wildfires, they get names. So should we name heat waves? Give us your hot takes on the heat. You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Do you take heat waves seriously? How do you stay cool? Let us know. And then Avi, we're also, we have an interview you did about 401ks, and the word doomsday is in the slug. Tell us about that interview. Give us the preview.
So the preview is basically that a lot of us do a type of investing called passive investing through 401ks and index funds. This has become more and more popular over the last 50 years. And there are some economists and high finance folks who think it's gone too far and it could tip the stock market into a calamity.
Oh my goodness. I have my thumbs on tap.
That's
after
the long
this.
And short of it. And what's somewhat interesting for our show is also there's a couple Philly connections to this story. It's not like a pure New York high finance story.
Yeah.
It's in many ways a Philly story. So we're going to get into those connections as
well. And then we have a new Easter egg contest. Psych, but I'm just joking. But there's a new contest here at WHYY for Studio 2.
Just to be clear, the contest does not involve actual Easter eggs. Because you said winner, winner, chicken dinner.
I know,
one time,
and people wanted their chicken.
Yeah, okay, so let's, that you were being metaphorical.
There will not be Easter eggs given out.
Got it.
Okay.
We need your help for this, so turn the radio up a little bit. You know that every episode of Studio 2 gets put on our podcast platform, and you can listen as a podcast. But we're going to do something very special for every Thursday podcast moving forward. We're going to put the episode up as a podcast, and then at the end, we're going to append a question.
Yes.
Okay? About that week's episode of Studio 2.
And if you listen to the shows, you should be able to answer the question.
Exactly. So it's sort of an incentive to listen. It's an incentive to download the podcast because we'd love for more people to find us that way, and it really helps when you download. And so if you answer the question and this, you send the right answer into studio2@whyy.org. Again, every Thursday, one lucky person among the correct answerers is going to get some Studio 2 swag.
And we have some cool swag.
Just trying to have fun with it.
Mug is a collector's item, I would say. Yes.
So we're very specific type of collector, but yes. So we're going to do that every Thursday. There's going to be like a little hidden question at the end of the Thursday podcast. We'd love for you to participate and answer, and hopefully we can keep it going if it becomes popular enough.
Yeah, and check out the podcast. Be sure to rate and review.
Absolutely.
So we're going to do news now.
Okay, so SEPTA. Of course, we've heard this over and over and over again. Since the pandemic, there's been an increase in what a lot of people would call antisocial behavior on SEPTA. That can include smoking and drinking and yelling and playing music too loud.
Using the bathroom.
That's super antisocial. So the transit agency says it's going to step up enforcement and try to crack down on these types of quality of life violations. They're going to raise the amount that they can fine you up to $100 for a first offense, that's for smoking specifically, starting July 1st. And they're also going to sort of reroute the way these tickets are handled and escalated so that it's not just a little $25 fee that if you ignore, you kind of can just get away with ignoring.
Yeah, and they can go after, put liens on property, all sorts of stuff to make sure they get their money.
More teeth.
Yeah, more teeth in it. And it's also like has moving away from the administrative work has sort of freed up SEPTA police to sort of do these patrols. And when they issue these tickets, apparently it's led to the discovery of some bad actors, people with warrants out for their arrest. And they've, you know, detained more than 100 people that had warrants. And so it sort of helped to make the system a little bit safer because these are folks who have had, you know, they found people with weapons and narcotics and all sorts of things. And so it's working to make SEPTA at least feel safer and actually safer.
Of course, when you do any type of enforcement, yeah. I always say this, right?
There's more interaction.
There's mm-hmm. there can be a downside. People can get caught up in
yeah,
cycles
sure.
of fines and debts. So there's something to be cautious of here. But I don't think it's an invention in people's mind that there was kind of a shift in behavior mm-hmm. on SEPTA during and after the pandemic. And there is some signs that it's already ebbing, by the way, but perhaps this will continue yeah. the trend.
And speaking of cycles, mm-hmm. especially when you're talking about interaction with law enforcement, Philadelphia rapper Meek Mill spent Juneteenth, which was yesterday, in New Jersey. Why did he go across the bridge? Well, he stood alongside Governor Phil Murphy as the governor announced a new clemency program that will allow some offenders to get early release. This program is a part of an effort to lessen the effects of mass incarceration and racial injustice due to the overzealous war on drugs. It'll also help with harsh parole rules that make it difficult to start over after incarceration. Now, this program specifically targets young and nonviolent offenders, as well as domestic violence and sexual assault victims who then had committed crimes against their offender there, and others who've had excessively long sentences. And so this is all part of, you know, justice reform in New Jersey. And if you remember, Meek Mill spent nearly a decade on probation and then was imprisoned for probation violations. He stood alongside Philly activist Wallow 267, who turned his life around after incarceration and has now become a very successful podcaster. So this is part of New Jersey's efforts to, you know, deal with the mass incarceration problem, which is ongoing.
Not a law, though.
No, not a law. It's a program.
It's a program. It's the governor using powers that the governor already mm-hmm. has, but in a different way, which is interesting. And we saw in the state of Maryland, our home state, the governor there, Wes Moore, recently pardoned, mm-hmm. I believe, 175,000 people with records related to drug use, marijuana mm-hmm. use. And so these are powers that governors have always had. They just haven't really used them in this particular way to try to make a systemic change. Usually you think of clemency and pardons. It's like a one-off, unusual case, someone who has a very high profile maybe. This is a very different way to use that type of power. Interesting and worth following.
Definitely. Worth following.
So I'm not going to say for this story that we're leaving Jersey mm-hmm. or that we're coming back across the river to Philadelphia. We're actually going to hover right above the river.
In between.
In the airwaves. Because there's some trouble. There's some turbulence. Okay. So boom parties, Cherry.
What are those? And I have to say, I've never heard of a boom party before this story.
Never heard. So then you've never been to one.
No, I've never been to one. No.
Okay. So boom parties are when lots of people get together, usually maybe like semi-abandoned kind of industrial-ish type of areas, mm-hmm. and they play music really loud out of these huge speakers. I'm raising my voice for the effect.
Yeah, you got the hands out, too. It looks really big.
Yes.
Yeah.
Why they do this, I don't know. Doesn't appeal to me. But apparently a lot of folks are doing this on the waterfront, on the Philadelphia side of the river, mm-hmm. and the noise is traveling across to New Jersey. All the way to Jersey. They're playing the music very loud, Cherry. These are boom parties. Mm-hmm. It's right there in the name. And the people on the Jersey side are getting increasingly agitated about this noise pollution coming from the boom parties in Philadelphia. You follow me?
Yes.
Okay, so the Courier Post had a story up recently about officials in Burlington City and Paulsboro and several other municipalities over on the New Jersey side sending letters to Philadelphia Mayor Sherelle Parker saying, take care of the boom parties.
Stop it, Mayor. And they say, you know, and the mayor has made public safety and quality of life
sure.
top of mind and one of her top priorities, cleanest, greenest, safest. How many times have you heard that? And so they're hoping that, I guess, she is very, you know, empathetic with their position and will stop this. I live near the waterfront now, and I've never heard any
I've
of this.
I've never heard it. Maybe they point the speakers Maybe the other way.
I don't know. Maybe they point it away from me. I don't know.
Could we have a boom party where people blast the Studio 2 podcast?
I would
and maybe
love
listen
that.
To the weekly trivia question?
Or something.
Yeah, because then the people in New Jersey would be informed about what's going mm-hmm. on locally. They would know more about boom parties if they
yeah.
listened to this episode.
And maybe they would rate and review.
Yeah, maybe. Just an idea.
So, folks, as I told you earlier, it's hot outside, and the Philadelphia Department of Health has declared a heat health emergency, and we want to understand more about what heat does to your body and what you can do to prevent health issues.
That's why we've brought in an expert. This is Samid Katana. He is a cardiologist at the Philadelphia Veterans Affairs Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Samid Katana, welcome to Studio 2.
Hey there.
And so, Samid, I want to start the conversation by you kind of walking through what happens to your body on a day such as this when it's extremely hot.
Yeah, so the human body operates in a fairly narrow physiological window in terms of temperature. And the body has lots of mechanisms in trying to control the temperature that affects the vital organs. So when people are exposed to high temperatures, especially for an extended period of time, lots of things happen. The heart starts beating faster and harder. We might start breathing faster. And then obviously we sweat. Sweating is a primary mechanism by which the body tries to expel heat, tries to take away heat from the core of the body to the periphery and then out into the environment. And if people are exposed to heat to even longer periods of time, especially if they have pre-existing medical conditions, then the body can start suffering various types of dysfunction. And that can include things like heart dysfunction, which is something that I study, which includes things like heart attacks, maybe even strokes, which is a blockage of blood flow to the brain. And then in the most severe forms, people can even suffer what's called heat stroke, which is something where people suffer neurological dysfunction like seizures and eventually even death.
Wow.
And what are some of the behaviors that people might engage in on a hot day that are counterproductive?
Yeah, so obviously being out in the direct sunshine, especially the hottest part of the day, which is usually late morning to early afternoon, that's something that can lead to some of these adverse health effects. Some people, for either because of work or other factors, maybe they don't have adequate shelter, might not have an option. But for other folks who are able to go into a cooler environment, that's something they should consider, especially in the hottest part of the day.
Are there signs, and I've had some issues in the heat, are there signs that you should be paying attention to that maybe the heat is too much for you?
Yeah, so a lot of the patients that I see at the Philadelphia Veterans Affairs Medical Center have serious medical conditions, serious heart conditions. And many of my patients will tell me that when they're out on a hot day, especially because a hot and humid day, they'll start feeling like they're having difficulty or they're breathing. Some patients who might have heart issues, they might feel some chest discomfort. They might feel that their heart is fluttering. Those kind of things might key you into knowing that maybe there's something going on with your body and that it's time to seek a cooler environment.
How about if it's not you, but someone you're with? Like, how could you tell perhaps that an older relative might be showing signs of adverse health effects due to heat?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because especially in older individuals, sometimes it's a little bit challenging. You know, you might see that someone's a little bit more lethargic. They might not be as alert as usual. You know, that I think can key you in that something is going on. And especially if they're complaining about things like difficulty with their breathing, maybe they might have a little bit of a brain fog, for example. They might have some difficulty with their with thinking and describing where they are. All of those are signs that maybe something is going on.
And so, gotta ask you, I mean, are there certain types of heat that are more dangerous than others, or is all heat equally dangerous?
Yeah, and you know, I think that's a great question, because this is an active area of research. Researchers trying to figure out, is heat that occurs earlier in the season, is that worse than heat that occurs later in the season? Summer season, that is. And there is some evidence that that probably is the case. Humidity is a key factor. So dry heat versus, you know, if there's a high level of humidity, that is probably affected as well.
Why would earlier in the season potentially be worse? Is it just we're less prepared?
Yeah, I think that could be a part of it. We're either less prepared physically, so people might not have installed their window air conditioners. They might be dressed for sort of a slightly cooler environment. But there might be even some physiological or biological factors that as the body is exposed to heat throughout the summer months, that perhaps it becomes a little bit more acclimated to the higher temperatures.
And so let's talk about who's at risk. I mean, Avi mentioned older individuals. Who should be paying attention to this heat I mean, I guess we all should be, but who should be really paying attention to the level of heat?
Yeah, definitely people who have certain pre-existing medical conditions. And these are conditions that are actually quite common. So that's things like high blood pressure, diabetes. If you already have, say, pre-existing heart and lung disease, so COPD and asthma, mm-hmm. or if you've had a prior heart attack. So those are people who are definitely going to be at a higher risk for that.
What about at night? You know, are there things that we can do at night to reset our body, to perhaps better prepare us for the hot day to come? Are nights potentially as dangerous as days? I mean, I'm guessing not as dangerous, but are there dangers lurking in the night? Because I imagine a lot of us maybe let our guard down a little bit during these heat waves once the sun goes down.
Yeah, nighttime temperatures are perhaps even more important than daytime temperatures. Mm. So our bodies have these very sophisticated circadian rhythms where we expect the nighttime to be cooler than the daytime, and the body naturally is resting during that time, expelling heat. And so there's evidence suggesting that hot nights might be even more dangerous for our health mm-hmm. Than hot days. And so researchers and public health authorities are becoming aware of that. The CDC and the National Weather Service recently created something called a heat risk score, where they try to take into account some of these various factors, including nighttime temperatures. And, you know, especially if you're sleeping in an environment that isn't able to be cooled down from air conditioning or other cooling mechanisms, that would be something that would place you at probably an even higher risk.
Yeah. Can we talk language a little bit? Because folks who are at risk or more vulnerable to heat, what should they be listening for when you're, you know, you're watching the news and you hear the meteorologist? What should you be checking for in order to determine how safe or unsafe it is to be outside?
Yeah, so I think various agencies are now using different terminologies, whether it's so at the university I work at, they use terms like red flag days. The CDC heat risk score that I just mentioned, I was using a color code to try and make it a little bit more clear cut. So if the color code is red or magenta, that suggests that this is a particularly risky day. Magenta is the color where it's risky for probably everyone, and red being a day that's a higher risk for people who have, say, pre-existing medical conditions.
Good to know. Red and magenta. Be on the listen out for those particular terms. That is Sameed Katana, cardiologist at the Philadelphia Veterans Affairs Medical Center and assistant professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks so much for being with us on Studio 2.
Thank you so much.
After this break, we're going to continue our conversation about excessive heat. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manarin.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. The heat wave in our region is expected to push temperatures near the triple digits by the end of the week. And as we heard earlier, heat puts a lot of people at risk for serious health issues. Philadelphia has announced its very first heat health emergency starting today. But is there a better way to get people to pay attention and to take heat waves seriously?
Here's one idea. Give heat waves names the same way we do with hurricanes. Would giving a name make people more aware and better prepared? And generally speaking, Cherry, how do we make our cities more heat resistant? Kurt Schickman is principal at KS Advisory, a climate resilience consultancy. He was also part of a study looking at this whole heat wave naming idea. Mm. Very interested to hear more about that. Kurt, welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And do you do anything to prepare for heat waves? How do you escape the heat? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And Kurt, we wanted to start the conversation with a definition. What exactly is a heat wave, and what counts, what doesn't count? And if you could tell us how that definition may have shifted over the years.
Oh, wow. You started with a hard question. The reality is we don't have a set definition of what a heat wave is. So different places in the country and in the world measure it differently. So oftentimes we talk about a heat wave based on maximum daily temperature. And we look at what we call the 95th percentile. So a day that is, 95% of the days are less hot than that day. But that's not a great measure for when a heat wave is actually dangerous and when we need to take action, because there are other factors involved. There's humidity. There's, nighttime temperature, which is actually more dangerous. High nighttime lows are more dangerous than high daytime highs, if that makes sense. So we've actually not done a wonderful job historically in measuring when a heat wave requires action, and that's part of the problem. That's changing. We are seeing, and you just mentioned the heat health advisory in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. We're moving in that direction towards actually measuring the impact of heat waves more on their impact on people rather than their weather conditions or the weather characteristics. And I think that's a really good thing. But really, what's a heat wave is actually seems like a simple question, but it's kind of a challenging one.
Can I ask you, Kurt, what type of definition would you prefer? Like, what do you think would be most effective if we were to circumscribe what a heat wave is?
Sure. So I think what's happening right now here in the U.S. with the heat risk system, which is what the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration and the CDC have put out, it's tied to human health outcomes that are locally specific. Mm. So it looks at more at what the impact of the different weather conditions are, because heat waves actually are dangerous, not just because of the conditions, but actually the conditions that people are living in.
Right. So not a lot of AC up in Maine, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So 95 there is going to hit different than 95 in Phoenix.
Exactly. And a 95 for me sitting in an air-conditioned house is very different than it will hit for a person who's living next to me that isn't running their air conditioner or can't, or is taking different medication that puts them at different levels of risk. So it's really an individual level disaster, not a even a community level one, like we're used to with hurricanes or tornadoes.
Is that one of the reasons why people tend to not really pay that much attention to a heat wave? Because, I was thinking about this when we were preparing for the show. I can't really remember a specific heat wave. And yet when I saw the death numbers, I was really shocked.
Oh, it's a great question. I think it's two things. I think one, we think, this is just how it is. And we just have to deal with it. And people have dealt with it. The reality is this is not just how it's been. It is getting hotter. We're dealing with different intensities of heat waves than we were before. So that's one aspect of it. We just have a low recognition of our actual exposure and risk. When we talk about this, oftentimes we're saying, oh, vulnerable people. And we're thinking of elderly folks, mm-hmm. or little children. In fact, it's, middle-aged and younger adults that are also at great risk. People that can't help but be outside for work and things like that, that are at great risk, but aren't necessarily communicated to in a way that helps them understand that. And then the other side of it is, we don't think there are many communities that feel like there's just not anything they can do about it. They know it's hot. They even may know it's dangerously hot, but they don't know that there are ways that they can address that heat for themselves personally and in their homes and in their communities and where they're living. So it's both of those things that I think combined that have made heat the silent killer that it is, as you said very well.
Interesting. Yeah.
We're talking with Kurt Schickman, if you're just joining us. And the topic is, heat waves and also heat wave messaging and communication. And you were involved in a really interesting mm-hmm. study in Seville, Spain. Lovely city, by the way. It gets very, very hot there mm-hmm. in the summer. Tell us a little bit about that study and what some of the broader implications are.
Sure. So we really wanted to get to a place where we were basing our warnings for heat on the health impact, as we were just talking about. And so in Seville, a couple of years ago, we launched a two-year pilot with the University of Seville, with Boston University, and the city of Seville itself, to institute a health-based warning system that was derived from the actual health outcomes that people had experienced in Seville over the years during summertime temperatures. So what we were able to do was to look at daily mortality and issue warnings, not based on how hot it was, but how the different conditions, the time of year it was, how the overnight conditions looked, humidity and other factors beyond just the heat, how that forecast would actually affect life in Seville. And we had a multi, you know, four phase warning system for that. And at the very top end, when we had the most dangerous days and occurring, and also over multiple days of those types of conditions, we had the option to name those heat waves. And so when I say that the most dangerous days, what I'm talking about in the case of Seville was a day that was at least where we anticipated an increase in mortality on that day that was 30% higher than what would normally be expected in the city. And so when those conditions were forecasted for at least 3 days in a row, we could issue a name. And we started doing that. The first named heat wave was Zoe. Mm-hmm. And then in the second year, we had four other named heat waves. And we did a study that looked at that first year and whether that had any impact on people's behavior.
And what did you guys find? Yeah.
So what we found was that, and again, I want to stress this is early days. Mm-hmm. There a lot more study needs to be done. But with that, I would say that what we found was, I'd say, a cautious optimism, that when people remembered that there was a heat wave that was named, and or whether they remembered the name, they took both. They took more preparatory actions than they would have otherwise. They took more response actions. So preparatory before the heat wave, response during the heat wave. And I think most critically, what we call pro-social behavior. So they were checking on neighbors and family and others to make sure they were okay. These are the hallmarks of how communities stay safe during the heat. These are better behaviors. And what we found was that there was a change. Folks that remembered that heat wave actually did more than those that didn't.
Triggered a response. Interesting.
Before the pilot. So I think it's a step in the right direction, I think.
Yeah, and I want to read a comment. Aaliyah says, when I know a heat wave is coming, I meal prep so I won't have to turn on the stove. And I think about when I hear names like Katrina, Sandy, right? Those hurricanes that stick in people's mind and they remember. Why do you think the names, calling it Heat Wave Zoe, and I don't know if that's how you referred to it, but why do you think people sort of took those actions? Is it a psychology thing? What is it?
That's a great question, and I think there's more study that's needed there, because I think it's two things. One, we really don't have, up until very recently, even for any disaster in this country, we don't base our warnings on health or on human outcomes. We base it on the characteristics of those events. So hurricanes, we base on the wind speed. Yeah. But there are other things that hurricanes do that are dangerous. So I think it's partially shifting away from those sort of physical characteristics of the weather and towards what it actually means for people. That's part of it. And you can message differently in those cases. So it's not just saying it's hot today. It's saying this is dangerous for this place. This is a historically dangerous thing. So that's one. And I think you're exactly right. Putting a name to something gives it an identity. And when we talk about heat waves, they come and go. They're deadlier than every other natural disaster we face, but they don't really have any way to identify them. So you have to come up with, well, do you remember how hot it was, 3 years ago in this place? We've seen some events in this country, like if you remember the Pacific Northwest Heat Dome, for example.
Yeah.
Not a great name. It doesn't roll off the tongue, but it is a way to define that. And so naming in some ways may be a better way for us to track and recall these dangerous events, these sort of historically important events in terms of weather, and hopefully spur more action and more behavior change around being prepared for those things.
I did find that heat dome imagery at least mm-hmm. evocative, although mm-hmm. maybe it would sort of run out its welcome if you kept using it over and over again. And that's kind of what Paul says. Paul says in a comment, we'd probably run out of names very quickly. Plus, I've always felt that the names kind of trivialize a very serious and critical issue. And I have felt that way sometimes watching the Weather Channel and seeing them name some like minor snowstorm. And again, that's just the Weather Channel probably doing its own thing. But is there a risk that the naming convention idea would eventually kind of run out of steam because people would, get used to it and start rolling their eyes a little bit?
I think there's a lot of issues we need to address here. I wouldn't want to come on here and say this is a solution for how we better prepare for heat waves. Yeah. It's one piece of it.
Yeah.
And so, yes, that's absolutely a piece. People can get tired of hearing about it. People get tired of hearing about heat waves in the summer without a name, and they certainly will potentially if they have one. There's also, a tornado and a hurricane are fairly easy to understand geographically. You know where you're in a tornado and where you're not. Heat waves are a little trickier. And so, how do we make sure we're warning the right people about heat waves and doing that in a sort of geographically appropriate way? So, for example, in Philadelphia, you may have extreme heat, and then 20 miles away, it may be perfectly fine, or it may not be dangerously hot. And so, you know, making sure those warnings are issued at the right time and for the right folks is critical, and a name may complicate that. And so I do think there's a lot to that. But I do think that, you know, based on what we're seeing, it does seem like it is getting people's attention. And so I think it is worth further exploration and trial to address some of those potential challenges.
Could be a tool in the toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we're about to wrap up. We have about 30 seconds left. Just any other tool that we could use to sort of get people to pay more attention to heat waves as they become longer and more intense?
Well, I mean, I think this type of program is exactly what we need. We you know, up until very recently, when you saw an article about a heat wave, you saw a kid eating ice cream or you saw a picture of the beach. And now we're showing the real human health impact of that in most of our images. I think it's taking it seriously, and not just for yourself. Even if you don't think you're at risk, you know, people in your life are. And that check-in is so important. So calling your neighbor, checking in on them, checking in on your family, checking in on your mom or your dad, your grandparents, those sorts of things. They seem trivial, but they are actually essential in making sure we're safer. And I think that's good behavior in any degree, but it's certainly in a heat wave.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. Thanks so much. That's Kurt Schickman, principal at the climate resilience consultancy KS Advisory. We appreciate your time today on Studio 2.
All right, and now we're shifting gears for the rest of the hour, and we're going to talk about money. There's a good chance that you, listening right now, are a passive investor. That means you got money in something like an index fund or a 401k. I know I do. So when the stock market does well, you do well. And over time, most people do quite well. As the name implies, passive investing feels low risk or harmless.
But Cherry, what if it wasn't?
Mm.
What if the massive boom in passive investing over the last 50 or so years is setting our entire economy up for disaster?
Oh, no.
I mean, it's real.
Mm-hmm.
Those questions are at the heart of a June cover story in Harper's Magazine. The cover says 401k doomsday, not very subtle. And while you might think a story about finance is a New York story, in many ways, this one is a Philadelphia story. To understand why, I spoke recently with the article's author, Andrew Lipstein, who, full disclosure, is an old college friend of mine, but I still think this topic is worth exploring regardless. Let's play the tape. I wanted to start really basic, because a lot of us have 401ks, or we invest through an index fund. When you look under the hood, what are those things basically made of? Like, if I put a dollar in an index fund, what happens to that dollar?
Your dollar is basically instantly, automatically split between all of the companies that are in that index fund. And, you know, one of the most popular index funds is the S&P 500. So that's going to be 500 of the biggest stocks in the market. Your dollar isn't split evenly between those 500 companies. More money goes to the bigger companies.
Okay, so you say that experts estimate that somewhere between 15 and 38% of the money in the U.S. stock market is passively invested. I mean, that's a humongous amount. How does that compare to 40, 50 years ago?
Yeah, for something that seems so intuitive, it's really kind of a new invention. Index funds, you know, passive investing really didn't begin until the 60s, 70s, didn't really start to gain traction until the 80s and 90s, and didn't really start taking off until the aughts. And when they took off, they really took off, which some doomsayers owe to regulation, investing trends, generational retirement funds going there. But it really hasn't been something that has sort of been a true presence in the market until around the past 20 years or so.
Yeah, because we all take it for granted, because for so many of us, this is the way that we interact with the stock market. But it is sort of surprising to read that it's kind of new, and in a sense, maybe not super tested, at least not over a long period of time.
Yeah, well, what isn't tested is its impact on the market. It's really a measure of the market. It's a fund that's supposed to capture the value that other players in the market are defining. So the actual price of stocks is defined by active investors, people, you know, actively watching a stock, buying it, selling it, and passive investing is really supposed to be like almost on the sidelines watching. And that has been sort of a fine way to think about things until recently, where some people are saying, hey, this investing vehicle that's really supposed to be watching the market and measuring it is getting so big that we can't sort of deny that it's having an active presence in the market and is actually might be distorting the prices of stocks.
Prior to this, the way a lot of people invested in the market, I take it, is that they paid someone who was picking stocks, picking winners, picking losers, paying them a fee. Now, the index fund comes in, and the way it undercuts that is that the fees are lower, right? Like, you don't have to pay too much off the top.
Exactly. So what happened was an economist named Paul Samuelson basically said, hey, you know, active funds aren't even doing that well. Why doesn't someone just make a fund that just tracks the market so we could see how well active funds are doing? And from that idea, the founder of Vanguard, Jack Bogle, actually decided to build a fund that that people can actually invest in that did that.
So Vanguard, and some of our listeners probably know this, is located in the Philly suburbs. It's not New York. It's not in the Mecca of finance. They're in this game. They're getting into this game like in the 70s.
Yeah, it wasn't a huge success in the beginning, but over time, it really took off, and it's now one of the big three players of index fund managers alongside BlackRock and State Street.
Okay, so before I read your article, my thought was the reason that Vanguard became so popular is because you're paying less, you're getting more. Of course, everyone's going to invest into this product. But you mentioned that 401ks, index funds are also propped up by some regulatory changes, like the government might be putting its finger on the scale a little bit here.
Yeah, so it's very American, at least in the past 50 years or so, for the government to want their retirees to have a healthy retirement. And the way that we've done that, basically since the advent of the 401k, is through investments in the market. Before the 401k, sort of the default model was pension plans, where you get a set amount. Now the way we do it is, before you retire, set money aside and invest that in the market. And what would be devastating for the government politically is if all of our 401ks took a nosedive, if the market started to go down and only went down, because sort of that whole paradigm of how we save for retirement would be a house of cards.
And so how does the government ensure that these are stable, growing investments? Because the government is not the stock market.
Yeah, and you know, this is controversial. In the piece, I profile a sort of index fund doomsayer named Michael Green, and he actually runs an active ETF. That's his main job. But he also is sort of the person to speak to if you are worried about passive investing, if you want to hear a sort of very trenchant, very educated point of view on passive investing. So I basically went down to Philadelphia to talk to Michael Green, basically to scare myself silly. And that's exactly what he did. I mean, he's the type of person who could speak to you for 5 hours straight, which is what ended up happening, you know, not breaking eye contact, answering every question you have within a millisecond of you asking it. And he believes there's been a few key regulatory shifts that have led to 401ks growing and becoming way more passive in the past 20 years or so. There's in 2001, you have the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act, and this is known as one of the Bush tax cuts. Then in 2006, you have the Pension Protection Act, which encouraged companies to automatically enroll their employees in 401ks. And then you have the Secure Act of 2019, which really incentivized employers even further and let them wait longer to withdraw funds.
Give us the scenario in which passive investing grows so big that it threatens the economy at large, the stock market at large. Like, how would that happen? Because on an individual level, it does seem so safe and, as the phrase implies, so passive.
Yeah, so there's a few aspects of passive investing that could make it a dangerous majority investor in the market. A passive market is very inelastic, and there's a high correlation. So what that means is that a slight shift in the market would result in a bigger shift in volatility, because passive investing doesn't really have a say in pricing. So the small number of people who do have a say in pricing would have a greater impact on the market.
Because what you're supposed to believe is that these prices are the result of really smart people making a lot of decisions, the wisdom of the crowd coming together, setting the price, and that ultimately that price is a reflection of the actual health of the company itself. I mean, isn't that the theory that undergirds all these prices?
Yeah, and what you're describing is what we call market efficiency, which is basically how well a market takes all available information and sets prices according to it. Passive investing operates very differently, which is that the amount invested in passive investing isn't really a function of what people think the prices should be. It's more a function of, do I have savings left over? As more and more people build 401ks and invest their savings in 401ks, the amount of money that will go into passive investing and index funds is really a function of how many people are retiring? How are people doing financially? And as that figure becomes totally divorced from the actual prices of the stocks in these funds, what happens when there's a generational shift or less people are retiring or people just sort of lose faith in the market?
The argument that Green and others make is that this is a type of bubble and that when this bubble bursts, it could set off a chain of events that are like really, really calamitous. I mean, can you explain what their like theoretical chain of events looks like?
There's a fact about active investing, which is that they keep a 5% buffer basically to soften outflows of cash or to jump at new opportunities. In passive investing, there's no such thing. And a lot of experts, Michael Green included, think that that could exacerbate the fall so that not only would the market start to go down and only go down in the long term, but that there would be such a rise in volatility that it would go down so quickly and affect only the biggest companies in the market to an extent that there would be no safe place to put your money.
Someone like Michael Green is an active investor. I mean, is it possible that these folks just have an axe to grind? They're the ones in the market making the bets, either making big money or losing their shirts. And they're watching everyone sit on the sidelines and just, you know, make a nice little profit based on all of their risk. I mean, is it possible that they're a little perturbed by that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, active investors do have an axe to grind. You have been better off just investing in the S&P 500 than taking your money to some exclusive mutual fund and paying basically 20 times the fees you would at a place like a Vanguard passive ETF or mutual fund.
Now, you are passively invested, and that's still the case, right? Even after writing this?
Yeah, I would say I didn't change a single allocation of a dollar based on this piece, mostly because I don't think, as far as my family savings goes, I'm smarter than the market.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of a better place to put my money than passive investing. I do think that a lot of this rests on there being an alternative for retirement funds and for people to have a safe retirement. I think a greater welfare system, a non-employee-based retirement fund and system would be useful for people to know that they'll have money left over when they retire that don't depend on, you know, the rises and falls of publicly traded companies. But I think that would be a bigger leap for government.
That is Andrew Lipstein, the author of What Goes Up? Does the Rise of Index Funds Spell Catastrophe? You can read it in the June edition of Harper's Magazine. Andrew, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much, Avi.
All right, you freaked out?
I did. I had my Tums ready, but I'm going to stand down with the Tums because Andrew didn't change anything. So I'm going to ride it out. So very interesting interview.
I think what's supposed to make you think is less like you're not supposed to panic. I don't think it's a panic story, but if you read the whole thing in Harper's, but I think it's just to make you consider that this investment vehicle we all use that has sort of been solid for 50 years, its whole, you know, existence isn't foolproof. No investment is foolproof. And so just like be mindful of that when you invest your money.
And maybe we ought to pay a little bit of attention.
A little bit. Just a skosh. Thank you for paying attention today to Studio 2.
Absolutely. That brings us to the end of today's episode of Studio 2 and to the end of our week. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray-Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer. Our audio general manager is Joan Isabella from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arrett. We will talk with you next week. Cherry.
Yes.
We've made it to the end of the Studio 2 week.
Yes.
So it's time for our weekly soon to be a tradition, Easter egg. Is that what we're calling it?
We're going to call it the Easter egg, but no Easter eggs will be distributed.
Disclaimer.
Okay?
Full contest rules on our website. No Easter eggs, but we do have a special prize of Studio 2 swag for one lucky person who gets the trivia question right this week. And this is a trivia question you would know if you listen to our week
of shows.
That's
all you have to do.
That's all you have to do. So
lay it out.
Yeah, right.
I'm ready.
Here's the question. Hers potato chips. They come up with three new flavors every year tied to local businesses. What are the three flavors this year? Name all three?
Yeah.
Send your answer via email to studio2@whyy.org. We're going to take all the correct answers, put them in a big metaphorical tumbler, pick one out, and then we're going to send one lucky person some Studio 2 swag.
And we have some cool swag. And by the way, I remember the answer because I was here for the show.
Don't say it, Jerry.
I'm not
going
to say it, but it's available. That's what I'm saying. Listen to the show.
And we would really appreciate also if you rate and review the show and subscribe. It helps us tremendously. And we hope to have a little fun with this over the weeks to come.
Yep. See you on the radio.
Bye-bye.
At your job, do you ever have to deal with a nose roller? How about a snub pulley? Well, if you're installing a new conveyor belt system, dealing with the different components can sound like you're speaking a foreign language. Luckily, you've got a team ready to help. Grainger's technical product specialists are fluent in maintenance, repair, and operations. So whenever you want to talk shop, just reach out. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.